This is Jeffrey Tucker of the Mises Institute. I'm sitting here with Mark Thornton, a resident economist in residence, and he's going to take us through the Mises Institute's market page, which is on the site. And I invite you to join us. If you go to the cover of Mises.org and go about to the middle of the front page, you'll see quick links, a second link, markets and data, labeled as stocks, commodities, money aggregates, and macroeconomic trends. And I'm clicking on it now so that Professor Thornton can take us through this thing chart by chart. We begin with the stock market, which is down 65 points today.
Yes, so we start with the Dow Jones Industrial Average just for the day. And it shows in the color graph at the top that the Dow Jones was down 65 points today. The next graph below that is the Dow Jones Industrial Average over 6 month period. The Dow Jones is in blue. The 50-day moving average is in red. And it shows that the Dow over the last 6 months is down about 30%, and it's getting close to its 50-day moving average, which that's just basically an indicator that if the your market moves past the 50-day moving average, that things may be changing, the trend may be changing.
Why is that?
Well, it's you know, short period of time versus long period of time, and it's something that technicians have looked at, and they look at the 50-day moving average, that if you go decisively through it, that means there's a change in the short-term trend. If you go decisively through a 200-day moving average, that's a indicator that the long-term trend has changed.
And you pay attention to these technical indicators because why? I mean, they obviously don't determine human action. It's because traders themselves pay attention to them, right?
Well, traders themselves pay attention to them, but they give you an idea of where you are in relationship to where you were, which gives you some feedback in terms of your fundamental model, your Right. theoretical model of what you think the world should look like. Technical apparatus that is used in the marketplace simply gives you some sort of picture of where you are in relationship to where you went, where you've been, so that you can put your own fundamental analysis and your theoretical analysis in perspective yeah. of time.
Yeah, and that's helped you to call markets. I know you're always coming in telling me about technicals and whether we've turned this point, we've got this, we've got a price break or whatever.
Yeah, they're just...
You seem to have a knack for this anyway.
So. Well, I'm not a technical analyst, but I follow technical analysts, and I know some of the basic tools, mm-hmm. some of the major things that have been, are just good guides of thinking,
yeah.
basically.
Okay, next, NASDAQ?
The next market is the NASDAQ, again, over 6 months, and this shows the NASDAQ down about 40% over the last 6 months.
Well, that represents some serious value losses, doesn't it?
Yeah, 40% of your money in 6 months is a serious loss, and that doesn't even represent the loss from the top. We're not talking about the top. We're just talking about the last 6 months uh-huh. on these charts.
How much, tell me something, you know, you get the sense that, you know, when you're at dinner parties, you're in private conversation with people that report their stock market losses to you, they're pervasive, aren't they, throughout the whole of society. Everybody's looking at their portfolios, devastation.
Right, and during the late 1990s, at cocktail parties, everybody was trying to come up with the highest percentage gain possible. Like, I made 400% on this stock trade, or my portfolio is up 60%.
Yeah.
And then there's this quagmire of time when people really didn't talk as much about their investments, and, you know, it may be up, it may be down, but nobody was really sort of gung-ho in either direction. But now you go to cocktail parties and it's, who could lose the most money?
Right, I was just thinking, right, that a certain status, like, you know,
I've lost 40%.
Yeah. And well, no, I've lost $500,000 in the markets. Whoa, impressive.
And sad, too.
Yeah, yeah.
The next chart down is the dollar index, which represents the value of the dollar against a basket of foreign currencies. This actually shows that the value of the U.S. dollar has been up 13%. Over the last 6 months, but at the end you can see that the value of the dollar has fallen, and it's fallen through that 50-day moving average. Okay, so this chart, the dollar index, shows that the value of the dollar has actually increased by about 13% over the last 6 months. But notice how it's been riding up that 50-day moving average, and now it's broken decisively through that 50-day moving average, which is a good indicator that the trend in the dollar, that upward trend in the dollar, is now over, and that the new short-term trend in the value of the dollar is going to be lower over the next few weeks or months.
And that means less purchasing power abroad. What's that going to mean for the U.S. trade, for the U.S. economy generally?
Well, I mean, it does a number of important things, and that's why we focus on the dollar so much at Mises.org. And, you know, a lower dollar is going to mean higher oil prices, higher commodity prices, higher gold prices. It's going to be more imports relative to what we would have imported, and more exports than we otherwise would have done. Again, this is short term, so the impact on foreign trade only takes place over a longer period of time.
Okay.
And very much related to this, and you'll see there is an ordering here where you look at one market and it naturally follows into the other, and that's why a lot of members of the Mises Institute and people who are on Mises.org use this as a way to study the market after the close of the day to see what's going on. And in this market on the gold, spot price of gold shows that over the last 6 months, the value of gold is down about 5%. But also notice that it's up 17% or so over the last month.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's gone decisively through the 50-day moving average. But gold and the dollar are pretty volatile, and so these signals, these short-term signals, are not necessarily all that helpful. And then below that, we have the commodity index, the CRB.
Yeah.
And this shows over the last 6 months the index falling from 450 down to almost 200, and actually it's a 50% loss in the value of the commodities. The price of commodities over the last 6 months. So there's been a huge deflation of commodity prices over that period of time. And, of course, that's a leading indicator of inflation and things of that, price inflation. Okay, and the next market that we're going to take a look at is the euro market. And you can see that's when in May, June, and July it peaked out at around $1.60 per euro. So you would have had to pay $1.60 to get 1 euro at the top. And then since that top, it's fallen down to as low as $1.25. So in the summer, euros were very expensive. In the fall, euros have decreased quite a bit. Down the value of the euro versus the dollar, down over 20% from peak to trough.
This is just more or less an inverse of the dollar chart above.
Well, the dollar chart above is versus all currencies,
mm-hmm.
and this is specifically on the euro, which is one of the major ones in the basket. But there is a difference between the euro-dollar exchange rate and the index, the dollar index, which is a reflection of all the world's major currencies.
Right. Next, we come to the astonishing oil price market.
Yes, yes, and not many people follow this series over time. People focus in on the short run value of oil because they pay for it at the gas pump every time they fill up their car. And so there's been a lot of puzzling events in the oil market, namely the run up to almost $150 a barrel and then the subsequent complete collapse of the price of oil. It's not actually reflected on this because we don't have, I don't believe we have daily prices on this, but the barrel per oil price was actually below $50, and today it's back above $50. It's very volatile. Why do oil prices spike up? Well, it has a lot to do with the business cycle, and if you look at the chart, you'll notice that oil prices per barrel spike up at the end the boom phase in the economy right before we turn into a recession. So as we've sort of stretched ourselves out so thin, as we pumped all the money and credit where all the producers are trying to complete their projects and they're consuming raw materials and they're consuming vast amounts of energy, both building and using all these new facilities that have been created in the boom, the price of oil spikes up higher. But then three things go into effect. First of all, there's conservation at higher prices. People buy less. And then, of course, people switch to more efficient uses of the energy sources. And finally, the recession kicks in and people no longer need to drive as much. We don't need to ship as much and we don't need to heat as many facilities and so forth. And so there's an increase in supply at precisely the time there's a decrease in demand. And so you see once that peak has been reached that it begins to fall. And the shaded areas on the graphs represent recessions. Okay, so there's a lead up, a peak in the price, and then the economy moves into recession.
This is what you heard some people talking about, Dominic Armentano and some others. I think you were talking about an oil price bubble, and really what this represents is the tail end of the boom, a sort of frantic rush to finish projects.
That's right. Yeah. I think it's Dom put it, the economy runs out of gas.
Yeah. Well, it has been a marvelous thing to see, and it's just a pure coincidence that the last time gas was this low was when the Democrats were in charge, right?
Right, and exactly. And you know, while everybody else was completely puzzled over this run up in oil prices, and then completely surprised that the price started crashing, you know, the people who come to our financial markets page every day and have been looking at the same graph and saw that run up in the price of oil, we're expecting the onset of the recession because it's just too obvious.
Yeah.
Especially if you look at it over and over again.
It's really obvious to me in retrospect.
You need to go to this page every day.
Okay.
Okay, the next page is our very own True Money Supply. This is a product that we're not borrowing from some other site, but that we actually construct ourselves. It's based on Murray Rothbard's definition of money. And then Joseph Salerno has helped us put this together. And we collect data from the Fed where we're looking at cash, we're looking at checking accounts, and we're looking at savings account money. Any money that's available immediately upon demand is in the True Money Supply. And it's been moving rather slowly or not at all most of this spring and summer, but the last couple reports have shown significant increases in the true money supply, as we'll see happens in most of the money supply measures. The next one is MZM, or money of zero maturity. This chart takes a similar shape to the true money supply, but at a different level. So Austrians in the past used MZM because it sort of followed the pattern of the true money supply, but now we have the true money supply available where people can go to this site, click on the graph, and download the data for themselves.
Yeah.
And what we're hoping is that a lot of people, a lot of students, graduate students, and financial professionals will start running studies using the true money supply in their analysis because we believe it is a better indicator of the actual existence of money and then the impact that money has on economic activity.
Yeah. An absence of that, an absence of the TMS, you like MZM?
That's a general consensus amongst Austrian economists, yes. And then there's M2 included in the site, which is sort of the mainstream view of the money supply. And below that, we have the St. Louis adjusted monetary base. And the monetary base is kind of the raw material of monetary inflation. If you have monetary base, which is, you know, cash and money deposited in banks, on reserve, that's sort of the raw material to use in terms of inflating the money supply and then causing price inflation down the road. And what you see is something astonishing, unprecedented in the history of monetary statistics, Most of the chart, you'll see this goes from 2004 to 2009, and most of the chart is just a little squiggly line, as if nothing has actually really happened except a general increase in the monetary base. And then in the last 3 weeks, a huge jump up, unprecedented jump up in the monetary base. Basically, if you, what has occurred in the last 3 weeks took...
The last three months.
Took an accumulative 3 years prior to that to increase the monetary base by the same amount. So that's incredible. That's the wild card. You know, what's going to happen to that monetary base going forward? It could be the fuel for some kind of hyperinflation.
Yeah.
And next we have the effective federal funds rate over the history from the 1950s to the present. And you see there's a gradual buildup, an erratic pattern that peaks out in the early 1980s. Then we get the Monetary Decontrol Act and the Monetary Freedom Act and relaxation of the old rules. And there's been a gradual, although erratic, decrease in the effective funds rate over time. And you'll notice again that there's a peaking out of the federal funds rate that occurs right before a recession period.
Mm-hmm.
And before the recession is recognized and in the boom phase, basically what you have going on in the economy is that the demand for loanable funds is exceeding the supply of loanable funds, and as a consequence, the federal funds rate is being pushed up, both by the market and by the Fed as well. And then there's the realization that the correction is going to take place, and at this point, the supply of money in this market is exceeding the demand for it. There's not as much demand because people realize there's a correction going on, and there's more supply, and as a result, the Federal Reserve and the market take that federal funds rate down. So again, the spikes in this market predict future trouble in the economy. So that's something to always be on the lookout. And as you'll notice, the federal funds rate now has basically just about touched bottom at zero. And there's word that the Fed is going to reduce the federal funds rate, the effective federal funds rate, down close to zero any day now.
If you had a free market for interest rates and for money, with sound money, what would you expect effective federal funds rate, I guess, if there would be such a thing, what would it do in a recessionary period?
That's a good question. I mean, if it was no intervention, I would expect the federal funds rate to usually be low, except during times of uncertainty, for that rate to change on a day-to-day basis rather than on a, you know, on the Fed schedule. So there would be a lot of differences. We certainly wouldn't have any kind of, the chart wouldn't look like this. And, of course, this is also related to the business cycle. So the volatility in the series is being generated in large part to the business cycle itself.
Yeah. Now, this next one, the mortgage rates are a little bit of a puzzle. Why wouldn't we, given the housing crash and the bad loans and everything out there, why wouldn't we see the 30-year mortgage rates soaring?
Well, we're not seeing the rates change that much because the Fed is keeping their rates low. But this is a little bit misleading because lending standards have changed dramatically. Since the beginning of this correction. Prior to this, I mean, they were giving money to anybody they could, you know, get their hands on. You had need no credit, you need no down payment. Now you need good credit. You need, well, we've just gone basically back to the old standards.
Yeah.
And 20% down, income history, residency history, all the rest. So the interest rate itself does not necessarily reflect completely the availability funds in this marketplace.
Can you trust the next chart, personal savings rate? I've heard a lot of people debunking this.
Well, there are things that you want to consider, but our personal savings rate has declined to zero. A couple of the things that people bring up is that money put into retirement accounts doesn't necessarily go into personal savings, and as calculated by this, and also corporate savings, which is another form of savings, is also not including this. This is, you know, how much of our personal income do we not consume and put into a bank in terms of savings. So there are some things you have to take into account, but those things are always in account. You know, our personal savings rate has basically been driven down to zero, where the normal range would be up close to about 10%. And in other countries, developing countries, it's much greater than that, 20, 30, 40%. And of course, this is a key to increasing your standard of living. So whatever adjustments you want to make to the personal savings rate, just remember that it is a key to prosperity, both for the individual and for the overall economy. And the fact that we've squeezed all the savings, most of the savings out of our economy, we've sort of fooled ourselves that our stocks are going higher and our house is getting higher, and so we haven't needed to save more money.
Yeah.
And but the key to the correction is to get savings, personal savings, back up into the normal range for an extended period of time. The direction it's actually going, we now show personal savings rate as positive over the last couple of reports. So that's a good sign, and it's predictable too. The savings rates always spike up as you go into an economic correction.
Well, actually, you see here that it seems to shoot up to 5%, and then it crashes again. Do we see this is a reflection of sort of countercyclical policy that initially?
Yeah, the 5% I think is the tax rebate period.
Ah, okay.
Which that actually kept us out of a recession.
Uh-huh.
Because without that money, GDP would have been negative during that period. So that was just a way of camouflaging the correction or the recession before the election. You know, you notice that they not only did that, but they revised all of the unemployment reports right after the election. We had this huge increase in the number of unemployed people, plus they revised the previous months upward. So, and I think that's always seems to happen. I don't know if it happens consistently, but they always sort of camouflage the negatives going into an election.
Yeah. Okay, now we move to macroeconomic trends.
Mm-hmm. And we're looking at real gross private domestic investment.
This one's, if you look at the, it seems like a perfect predictor of recession again and again and again throughout the whole series, the whole history of the chart.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why Austrians emphasize this as key variable for understanding the macro economy and the cycle. And that's why we have it on our page. And that's why you'll probably never hear it mentioned on CNBC or, you know, business channels and business newspapers and so forth. But we think it's very important. One thing about this is that the reporting on this is delayed significantly. Mm. So we're looking at a chart that ends in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
It peaks in 2006 and then comes down a little bit in 2007. And we don't show what's happened so far in 2008, even though we know we're in a recession. And I would bet dollars to donuts that number is going to continue to fall going into that period. And private investment is how much we save then gets turned into investment, then we get more productivity. And so this is a key thing. And private investment ranges anywhere between 12 and 18% of overall GDP. 12% when we're in a deep correction, 18% when we're in a boom economy. Okay. The next category is real private fixed investment. And this is just business investment, what we saw in the previous graph, except that we don't include inventory, business inventory in that market. So that's a little redundant, but if you want to look at the numbers carefully, changes in inventory are important indicators when we look at changes in the overall business cycle.
Now we move on to prices.
Yeah, the Consumer Price Index.
This is a little bit puzzling. Is the data dated here? Because it shows the CPI for all urban consumers going up, and yet there's all this deflationary pressure.
Well, there's a lot of prices that are going up. The commodities are going down, but consumer goods are going up. And it's interesting, this chart takes us all the way back to the founding of the Fed. You see where the blue line goes all the way back to the founding of the Fed. And when you look at the gold standard period under the Fed from 1913 to 1971, the line is fairly flat, fairly stable. There's a lot of dips in there. Of course, we've got the Great Depression and the wars and so forth. And then in the early 1970s, we go off the gold standard completely, and then the line takes off in an upward inflationary spiral.
Yeah. Hard to deny.
Yeah, and you can notice either within the graph or you can actually go to the data itself, and with respect to consumer prices, since we went off the gold standard, we have higher prices during the recessions. Okay? So you get price inflation during recessions. Prior to when we were on the still on the gold standard and you went into a recession, consumers got lower prices.
Yeah.
So there was price deflation for consumers during recessions, which helped them out.
Right.
Now when we go into recession, consumer prices rise very quickly, which makes it even more difficult for the average person out there to deal with the consequences of a recession.
Right.
And then we go to the producer price index, showing producer prices. Again, they tend to spike going into the correction as the boom period has sort of a blow-off phase. Prices for producers rise very rapidly, and of course that's one of the reasons you go into correction, because business costs have risen.
I see.
The next one is the implicit price deflator for gross national product. And this is just a more encompassing measure of price inflation. In effect, you're taking CPI and PPI into account and looking at overall GDP and price increases. Now, this is very important, the civilian unemployment rate. And this is something that gives away a nice story, too, because we see the unemployment rate takes off at the beginning of the recession or the correction.
Like clockwork.
Like clockwork, that's right. And we've kept this up here for years, and because we think it's a good indicator. When you start seeing the unemployment rate bottoming or stabilizing and then start to move upward, you are pretty well informed or that the correction is beginning. And, of course, the NBER people who are supposed to call recessions and the people on CNBC who are telling you to buy stocks, unless the recession is officially called, they can go on with their rosy stories. But if you're looking at the unemployment rate and you're looking at this graph, you can just put those stories in the circular file.
And so what we have here is a reallocation of labor resources in the same way that capital is being reallocated to adjust to the new economic realities.
That's right. That's right. The change in unemployment, it's given in percentage terms here. 1% unemployment rate represents about 1 million people. So you can see that the increase in the unemployment rate basically is freeing up 1.5 million people who are out there currently looking for a new line of work.
So we have a shifting of lines of production. People move from one type of industry into another type of industry, and you also have downward pressure on wages to some extent.
That's true, and you know, and that's under the gold standard. That downward pressure on wages made this adjustment process rather quick. That's been diminished by a number of factors to slow down that adjustment phase. But even then, you can see from the chart that the adjustment takes place very rapidly.
Yeah. Unions can subvert this to some extent.
To some extent. They slow the whole thing down.
Yeah.
And we come to imports of goods and services. The general tendency here is for it to increase as world trade has increased. And you'll notice it becomes clear after we go off the gold standard that imports decline during recessions or corrections. This is most noticeable in the recession of 2001. So far, we don't show an indication of imports declining, but you can bet with pretty good odds that that number is going to decline from its current rate in future reporting periods.
And this will, to some extent, boost domestic production.
That's right.
And create an illusion of recovery?
A recovery in certain industries.
Uh-huh.
You know,
like, oh, look, the great steel industry is making a big comeback. The beef industry is doing so well, or whatever.
Well, right? 2007, 2008, our exports, for example, were very strong in certain industries in response to the falling dollar.
Yeah.
And so the international aspects are going to be influenced by the value of the dollar and the overall level of economic activity around the world.
Although we could see an increase in the number of imports of cars, though, I would expect, right?
Could be drastic import increase. I really don't think that's going to happen, but it's certainly possible.
Yeah, yeah. This next is a puzzle. I always like to show this to people when they complain about Clinton's big spending habits.
Right. It's really the only substantial budget surplus on the books throughout going back in our history, at least through the 20th century. And again, this chart, you're looking at it, it's basically a flat line. Then we have World War II. It becomes a little bit wavy, but still sticks to that zero level. And then we go off the gold standard in 1971, and the thing goes completely unhinged, completely erratic, with a general tendency towards budget deficits and, of course, an increasing national debt. And one can only imagine where the line is going to end up in the next reporting period. I guess this is clearly an indication that it's going to go off the charts.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be greater than that level. And they're going to have to readjust the size of that chart box.
And what a picture the Bush years have left.
Oh, yeah.
What a picture.
Yeah. Well, there's some definite signs that you can analyze this over the 8 years of the Bush administration and pick out various pieces of data. A gentleman I was talking to yesterday said that, well, I guess FDR is no longer the worst president in U.S. history. And I said, well, if you go to Mises.org financial page, you'll find statistical evidence to that effect.
Yeah, it's a real shock. It's the 8 years reduced to one plummeting line, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess the slight uptick there from $400 billion deficit to $200 billion deficit is a response to some extent, a forecaster of the coming recession, because you had an increase in tax revenue, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly wasn't spending cuts.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
And then the big daddy here, gross federal debt. Again, we have down by the zero line until we go off the gold standard, and then a very rapid increase. And then you get to 2000. This is where Clinton's sort of leveling off, getting a budget surplus. And then George Bush takes over, and it goes up like a skyrocket. And basically, he increased the national debt by over 30%. So, you know, we go over 200 years, and within 8 years, he increased the national debt by more than 30%. It's really hard to tell how much it's been increased because we don't really know the implications of what's happened here at the end of his term. And, you know, some economic historian is going to have to go back and say, what was the real national debt increase under George Bush if we include all of the subsequent money that is going to be wasted on account of the policies of his Treasury and his Federal Reserve, his FDIC and the whole rest? It's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, so in other words, come January, just because we get a new president doesn't mean that we're going to be done with Bush. We won't be done with Bush for a few years.
No.
Or maybe ever.
We've got Iraq. Yeah. We've got the budget in tatters, the economy in tatters. He's destroyed our image. He's destroyed our Constitution.
Yeah.
And now he's destroyed the credit of the nation.
Yeah.
All in 8 short years.
What a legacy.
Seemed like a nightmare.
Yeah. Okay, gross federal debt. Now, here we have just the amount of debt that the public is holding.
Right, which is about 60% of the total, and the rest is held by central banks such as the Fed or the Chinese Central Bank or the Japanese Bank of Japan, things like that. Just a reflection of how much is in private hands.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the government expenditures, showing us to be at about the $3 trillion level of federal government expenditures. Seems like a lot. And then there's government revenues. Government revenues fall in recessions.
Yeah.
In response to lower economic activities. And that was clearly the case in the recession of 2001, and it's already started in the depression of 2008.
Yeah, so just as government spending has taken off, we got revenues plummeting. I see what you mean about the deficit. That's going to be an interesting thing to watch.
Yes, and of course, the deficit feeds the debt, and the debt is what sort of invites new monetary inflation.
Yeah.
To monetize that debt away. And of course, the end game in all this is hyperinflation.
Yeah. Yeah. Weimar. So now we come to a very strong culprit of spending over the last 10 years.
National defense, yeah. This shows, low defense spending, from the World War II to, the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
And there was a big run up during the Reagan administration. And then a curtailment during the Clinton administration, yeah. And then it skyrockets during the Bush administration. Yeah. Basically, George Bush doubled defense spending in 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the commitments are still out there for all of that spending to be at those high levels. And, of course, we're destroying so much capital and so much equipment that it's not like we've invested in a lot of equipment that we can now cut back on. We've been out there destroying our own equipment. So, essentially, if we wanted to maintain our defense, it means only higher levels of spending to put all that.
Sort of makes a mockery of the whole limited government rhetoric of the Republicans, doesn't it?
I'm speechless. I can't, I can't really add anything to that.
So it's almost as if everything's the opposite of what it seems. You know, you look at the data, you compare it with the rhetoric. It's two different worlds.
That's right, and that's why I always encourage our members to go to the financial page of Mises.org to get the facts. I mean, we're not opposed to facts here. We're big on theory, but the best thing to confront these bad ideologies and these bad images that are presented in the media is to go look at the facts. And I think, looking at this maybe once a week or even once a month gives you a perspective of actually where we are and what we've done. And it doesn't take a high-powered computer to make calculations and to draw lines and things like that on these graphs to see exactly where we are.
Well, you've given us a fantastic tour, Dr. Simon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.